Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2:03 p.m. and that is Pacific... No, it isn't. It is Central Time. And today is Friday, so it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I thought we'd kick off with coal prices in Newcastle, Australia. And the price has done spectacularly well over the course of the last year. So it bottomed around the same level as it did back in 2016, in September of 2020. And since then, the price is up more than 300%, and a little softer in here today, but certainly not in an overly dynamic manner. Now, obviously, it's an accelerating trend, so it can't last indefinitely. But it is being driven entirely by demand for coal. And that is despite the fact that the media would have us believe that coal is no longer used and that it is a doomed market and that no one's ever going to use it again. I saw a rather interesting graphic earlier on in the week, which I thought was particularly relevant to this discussion. So this is China's energy mix. And at present, we're looking at the coal market not declining in any meaningful manner for at least the next decade. So until at least this year, they've continued to build coal-fired power stations. And we might describe that as trying to get in a few additional power plants under the wire before they stop producing them. But it means that China is going to be burning coal for the foreseeable future. And I think you would have to be very brave to make a prognostication about energy demand beyond a decade. But you can see that people are really ambitious in terms of what they think is going to happen, not just over the course of the next decade, but from all the way out for the next 40 years. Well, the only thing I know is that within the next 40 years, I hope to retire. And that's about all that I'm willing to predict. But when we think about the fact is that we're now at 2021 and people are starting to make predictions about what the energy mix is going to look like in 2065. That is extraordinarily ambitious and in many respects might be considered hubristic. But the reality is that China is going to be burning coal for years to come. And that is going to be equally true of India. In fact, it might be even more true of India because they are at a less developed condition than China is. So we're going to have continued extraordinary emissions coming from some of the biggest emerging markets for the foreseeable future. The kind of technology transfer that would be required in order to avoid that outcome, and the kind of surety that would have to be provided to those emerging markets in terms of commodity prices, and the building out of natural gas networks that would have to be funded in order to avoid that coal consumption, is on an order of magnitude relative to the kind of money that's being spent on foreign aid. So we're talking about an almost certain environment that coal demand is going to persist. Of course, nobody wants to hear that. And then we can also think about the hydro mix. So there's been a lot of hydro investment in China, but it's going to increase by 2065. So does that mean they're going to find new rivers? And where exactly are they going to build these additional dams that could make up approximately 5% of the total energy mix? But this is, I think, perhaps the most interesting, that the energy consumption of the economy today is probably around 42, and they estimate that it's only going to increase by about 5 over the course of the next 60 years, or, well, 55 years. Now, that's extraordinarily bearish. How is it that China is going to grow its GDP without relying on energy? And there has been this extraordinary, I think, extrapolation of a conclusion. Because in many respects, we've seen that highly developed economies have been able to break their reliance on energy to deliver economic growth because of the significant increase in the weighting of less energy intensive industries like software, the services sector, the aeronautics sector, and then also in biotechnology and healthcare. So they're less energy intensive than the metal bashing that economies have traditionally relied on. So, in estimating that China isn't going to have an increase in per capita energy consumption in the next 50 odd years, then they are simply concluding that the size of the economy, in terms of metal bashing and manufacturing, has reached its zenith, and that the per capita consumption of individuals is not going to keep pace with the present trajectory, and that that alone seems to be an even more hubristic prediction than we've seen with the anticipation that coal demand will disappear entirely within the next decade. So we're at an interesting juncture. We're seeing that there's these kinds of big long-term forecasts are being made with a high degree of confidence. And that should be giving everybody pause because it's difficult to make predictions about what's going to happen over the next 6 months to a year. And we need to have some basis in cycles to think about what will happen over the course of the next decade or decades in terms of secular bull and bear markets. But when we talk about a key commodity for the global market disappearing in importance, well, then we don't have a basis to support that. We can go back and think about the Jevons paradox, where he predicted more than 200 years ago that the UK would run out of coal, and that that consumption would greatly outstrip the ability of the country to mine the resource, and that the economy would crash as a result. And of course, 100 years later, because of better technology, the UK was producing more coal than ever, and the economy continued to grow. So it's not like we haven't had these kinds of these kinds of very negative predictions made in the past, and they haven't really come to fruition. When we think about the solar sector, it did spectacularly well in 2020, and I think it's relevant to consider that the prices peaked around the December through January level. And then we can think about bond yields. Because one thing that's particularly true of renewable energy is that it's very interest rate sensitive. So in December of last year, bond yields broke above 1%. They continued to trend higher, and during that period, we saw the renewable energy sector beginning to top out. And over the course of the last few months, it's been steadying. And a good part of the reason it's been steadying is because bond yields have been coming down. So now we can also then think about how that is impacting the wind sector. The solar and wind sectors, they are carbon neutral. So, but the wind sector, having popped on the upside last week, came down rather heavily in here this week, and bond yields are starting to steady up again. So, in many respects, we saw a complete step change between the performance of the renewable energy sector and the oil sector, and that started to occur at the end of 2018 because renewable energy started to break out. And we can see that with this wind ETF, that we started to see the prices moving higher in the beginning of 2019, and they were really starting to break out to new recovery highs at the end of 2019. And then, of course, they got walloped by the pandemic. And up until that time, we had had this really lockstep move between oil prices and renewable energy, because it was considered impossible for renewable energy stocks to attract interest unless oil prices were surging higher. So while oil prices were starting to steady and break out in early 2019, renewable energy was breaking out in early 2019, oil prices were quite weak, and they had been going sideways to down for most of 2019 while renewable energy was going upwards. So that started to break the link and the reliance of renewable energy with oil. And because that occurred, I think that has been the causal event that allowed investors and analysts to then conclude that this reliance on oil prices has been broken, and therefore it's possible that emerging markets will be able to also break their reliance on energy to provide economic growth. But that doesn't stand up in terms of in just simple argument, because the intensity of and then the industrial reliance that those economies have, particularly in China, on steel production, aluminium production, and home construction, those aren't easily just closed off. And they are significant portions of the economy, and manufacturing is a very significant portion of the economy. You can think about the fact that Foxconn at the moment is looking to hire 200,000 people for the production of the iPhone 13. So that's just for the production of one model. And obviously, producing iPhones is not especially carbon intensive, but it does help to highlight the reliance of the Chinese economy on significant manufacturing. So oil prices are doing better, and oil is firming from the region of the trend mean, and we had a large upside key reversal in the course of the last 3 weeks. So it bounced in an emphatic fashion from the region of the simple moving average in the 3rd week of August, and then it has been steadying around $70. It was weaker yesterday, stronger today, but the most important thing that it has done is bounce from the $65 area with the upside key reversal, and it suggests that we'll probably see prices go back up towards the $80 area. But in order for oil prices to break on the upside, we're going to have to see a significant supply event. So there's plenty of oil around. Now the big question is, and it is a it's a theory being propounded at present about whether U.S. domestic onshore unconventional supply has peaked, or at least are we reaching peak growth? Well, it's reasonable, I think, to think that we're reaching peak growth, because we've seen the supply increase in the U.S. by about 4 million barrels a day, and it's unlikely that it's going to grow by that number again in the next decade. So we are potentially reaching peak growth, but that doesn't mean that supply is immediately going to decline after that. I think it's much more likely today that what we're seeing is a reliance on funding, because one of the things that helped to propel the shale oil and gas sector was access to abundant credit, where there wasn't really a great deal of focus on profitability. there was a mad rush on to secure land leases and to get as many holes dug as possible to secure those land leases. But now we're in a situation where we've had a great deal more focus on profitability. So there was a lot of hedging went on in 2020 and in early 2021. And now there's a lot of productions not especially profitable, so they're not investing a lot in new drilling. And that gives the impression that we're not going to see drilling pick up in future. But of course, if prices sustain a move above $80, then there will be a supply response because those shale drillers will be able to lock in profitability at really attractive levels. And then you also have the fact that interest rates have been an additional factor that have deterred additional drilling because yields continue to push higher. And it's a very capital intensive market. Drilling an unconventional well is significantly more expensive than a conventional well, and you need to drill repeatedly in order to ensure that you can sustain production. So you need to have both high prices and access to abundant liquidity in order to make a business out of it. And with the withdrawal of liquidity, because people are worried about being associated with fossil fuels, then that's something that is deterring a lot of investment in the sector. So that's helping to support prices. And we would need to see the significant leveling off in terms of the supply surfeit and OPEC's significant, what is it, something in the region of 8 to 10 million barrels a day being held off the market. And that would, I think, really be about thinking about a full economic recovery in terms of the global economy to absorb all of that additional supply. But we're still in a bullish environment overall. I think we're going to see higher to lateral ranging, not surging high prices. But when we go back and then think about this reliance of renewable energy on oil that was broken in 2019, but it doesn't mean that renewable energy suddenly then was able to profit on its own. I think it's much more likely that what we have now is was a transference of reliance on oil prices to reliance on low interest rates. So when we think about Sunrun, for example, it's been one of the better performing solar operations, and its business model is totally reliant on access to cheap liquidity. So it's an extremely interest rate sensitive business model. And these kinds of business models proliferate in the renewable energy sector. So the performance of these shares is, in many respects, going to be a function of what happens with interest rates. Then we can think about what's happening in the uranium sector. Uranium sits outside of the both the renewable and the conventional sector. And there's increasing tightness in the market. The prevailing condition in the uranium market from 2012 through to about 2017 was a price war. So Kazakhstan's the uranium mining company engaged in massive supply dumping onto the market to capture market share. We got to a situation in 2017 and 18 where Cameco closed down their biggest mine, and they were able to buy on the spot market at rates below their production level so that they could still fulfill their long-term contracts without having to do any mining. So that was a reflection of just how much uranium was being oversupplied to the market. Well, that was a few years ago, so that oversupply has started to be chipped away at. Kazatom is now in a position where they would prefer to make money than make market share. And you have Sprott Asset Management, who have now moved into the market and are buying up available supply on the spot market. So that source of a new demand driver is rapidly eroding any kind of supply dominance and creating a deficit. And prices are now starting to rally in a rather impressive manner. So the uranium miners are taking off. They bounced 2 weeks ago from the region of the trend mean, and since then it's gone from just under 20 to 26. So we're seeing a significant move on the upside here. And this has been a sector which no one was interested in, and where a significant number of the companies went bust, and the ones that didn't were existing in a very marginal environment. We can think about, for example, Energy Resources of Australia, where it's majority owned by Rio Tinto. And were it not for that ownership, the company would have gone bust. So it is now just beginning to firm from the upper side of the base formation. And we can go back and look at the back history, because this was one of the bigger uranium plays back in the bull market that started off in 2004, 5, and 6. So prices today are still below where they were all the way back in the period from 99 through to 2003. So there's certainly more interest now flowing into the uranium sector. Paladin Energy has popped on the upside last week and improved upon that performance this week, but is a little bit overbought in the very short term. And we do need to see more than a decade of back history just to highlight where these prices traded during the last big bull market. Because back then it was all about the big building plans and of China and the inability of the mining infrastructure to keep pace with the potential for demand growth, because a lot of the weapons-grade uranium that had been was being provided by Russia as part of the nuclear wind down in the aftermath of the Cold War was starting to run out. So there had to be a big mining response. Then most of the mines went bust, and we have this environment now where there were big plans underway to completely close down nuclear energy, and an increasing number of states and countries are reaching the conclusion that it's not such a great idea because they need base power. So we continue to see these environments where we're getting spotty electricity provision as a result of renewables. There's a flex alert right now in California, because of the reliance on wind and the inability to keep going when there was frosty weather. Texas went through a massive power cut earlier this year. There's a threat of blackouts in Ireland right now, because of low wind. And this is not the kind of condition that people in developed markets are used to tolerating. So, the plans underway to close down nuclear reactors don't look like they're going to come to fruition. And at the same time, China is in the process of commissioning its first thorium reactor. So, we're starting to see some of the Generation 4 reactors coming online, which are inherently safer. And then that also should help to alleviate some of the fears that people have about both nuclear proliferation but also safety. So we're in this interesting environment with regard to energy, where the most benighted of commodities is surging higher. Natural gas prices are also surging higher, and the US natural gas price is really just playing catch up with the UK natural gas price, which is accelerating at a really quite profound rate. So, this kind of acceleration will not last indefinitely. And the opening up of the Nord Stream pipeline, where they anticipate sending through 50 million cubic meters of gas a year, that's going to help to ease some of the supply pressures in Europe right now. But one thing that we can also think about is that we've had extraordinary amounts of volatility in commodities over the course of the last couple of years. And we've had these incredible advances that seem to defy credulity that natural gas can go from 10 to 145 in the space of little more than 12 months, and that the basis upon which our just normal lives are reliant, that we can have these extraordinary moves without a lot of news being associated with it. Well, this is at least in part a reflection of the lack of investment and a lack of money that's flowing into the fossil fuel sector, that it's difficult to get money to do very much of anything in it. And the companies themselves, well, they're quite happy to allow these prices to rise because they at least they perhaps hope that it will put some manners on the political class. And then, of course, we have the additional point that carbon credit prices continue to rally. So they were a little bit softer in here today, and we have a short-term overbought condition. But the reality is politicians want this price at 100. They want carbon prices high enough to create an incentive to switch away from fossil fuels, regardless of how uncomfortable that's going to be and what kind of pressure that's going to represent in terms of inflation. And I think this is particularly relevant when we think, sorry, that's the wrong chart, when we think about wages. So I created, or I guess I recreated this chart that John Authors had produced on Bloomberg today. And he was simply looking at the high-skilled worker wages and low-skilled worker wages, but I wanted to look at that in terms of inflation. Because we had an incredible decline in inflation from a rather high level in 2008. And then we had a very big rebound, and that rebound in inflation took about 2 years. And after that, inflation moderated significantly. So then we had a big decline, but nowhere near as big a decline in inflation during the first quarter of 2020. And we've had an almost equally large advance off the lows. But we're in a very different environment today. The credit crisis was a liquidity crisis, and it represented a very swift contraction in leverage and a lot of businesses going bust because of access to liquidity. Well, the pandemic crisis was blunted by massive money production, and the majority of businesses were able to soldier on. Now, there are lots of mom-and-pop businesses, and there are lots of smaller businesses didn't make it through. And that's particularly true in terms of the services economy, but low-end services. When we think about services, Most people think about tourism as being a service sector or restaurants being a service sector, but then Google is also a services company and Amazon is a services company, and they did perfectly well during the pandemic. Low-wage workers are now demanding higher or de demanding faster wage increases than high-skilled workers. And those wage increases are not keeping up with inflation. So central banks are pretty much universal in concluding that we are looking at a transitory move in inflation. And the example that they're using is similar to what happened in 2009 through 11. They believe that because of the big decline, that it was just on a year-over-year basis, any form of recovery relative to what happened a year earlier is obviously going to translate into higher inflationary measures. And then, with the provision of liquidity and the economic recovery, and because businesses went bust and supply contracted but demand increased, it's obvious that there's going to be some form of modest inflationary pressures. And they're thinking that that's not going to last because there'll be a supply response as prices rise. So they think that this is an anomalous factor and that this pop in inflation, which is similar in magnitude to what occurred ahead of the big decline in 2008, is a transitory factor, and that this long range where we've seen spikes to up to about 5% have never been sustained over the course of the last 25 years. So they believe that this isn't going to last. So what's different this time that might in fact make it last? Well, one thing is that we're trying to change the economy, and governments everywhere are introducing carbon taxes. And this carbon tax and the protectionist way in which Europe has pretty much enforced the rest of the world to accept its carbon taxing measures, then it gets added on to the cost of oil, because surging oil prices are a drag on economic growth. So we don't have the same kind of surging oil prices today as we had in the period up from 2005 to 2008, or from 2009 through to 2011. Back then, prices went from 40 to 120. That's not quite the same thing as 20 to 80, just on a pocketbook and how much it costs to fill up your car basis. So, in order to see really big inflation, we would need to see the price pushing through 80, and then adding on the carbon price on top of that, then that really starts to become a really big headwind because the tax on oil has increased. So its consumers end up paying that, and those costs get passed on. And then we also have the additional factor that we don't just have carbon pricing, but we also have events like IMO 2020 in the shipping sector. So the Baltic Dry Index has pulled back now over the last 2 weeks, and it's a little overbought in the short term, so we may see some additional consolidation going on here. But the most important factor is that it has completed the base formation, and I really think it's unlikely that prices are going to go back down into the base. The cost of complying with IMO 2020 emission regulations for the shipping sector means that they're going to have to pass those costs on to consumers. So it suggests that the shipping rate is going to be at a permanently new, higher plateau. And those costs are going to be absorbed by consumers. So, on the one hand, we have the regulations on emissions that are adding costs. We have then the carbon trading platform that supports the efforts to counteract using emitting technology. Well, then that is an additional cost. And then we have the whole effort to deter investment in fossil fuels, adding on additional inflationary pressures. Well, we did not have that in 2008 and 9. There was certainly a lot of people talking about renewable energy ahead of the credit crisis and the need for a substantial investment in attempting to get out from the burden of paying for very high energy prices, but there was not the same kind of taxation. So we've had both regulatory taxes, regulatory burdens, and then outright taxation, and then a deterrence on investment to capture higher rates, all impacting the energy markets. So that's not going away. And when we think about transitory factors, well, we are starting to see these spiky patterns occur where we're getting, at first, we had this profound advance in lumber prices. So that was completely reversed. And now prices are beginning to steady around the 400 level. And again, this looks like another permanently higher plateau. So we're likely to see continued price support around the 400 level. Then we can think about the steel price and iron ore futures. So the Singapore futures price went up very significantly and gone from about 175 to 225 in the space of about a year, and then subsequently pulls back. But the big question then is, how much further will it pull back? Is it going to come all the way back down to that 75 level, or are we going to start to see support coming through relatively soon? Well, we've seen the big push higher in natural gas prices. There will be a response, particularly from Nord Stream 2. So this is another one of these examples where we have a short, sharp bout of inflationary pressures, where electricity prices hit records, and then the price will moderate. But then it is also likely that it'll come back down and find support at a somewhat higher level. And these kinds of effects on the market, they're not entirely because of the pandemic, but more they're because of these regulatory events and the changing macro environment, where there's just a great deal of hostility being expressed towards any form of carbon production. Then you have stories like this week where the world's largest carbon capture facility was opened in Iceland, and they anticipate something like well, it's a risibly small percentage of global carbon emissions. And these kinds of production facilities don't work for free. So it's another additional cost being layered on. Now, I'm not making a comment on how worthy the objectives are, but simply that these types of events don't happen for nothing. And there's obviously going to be a knock-on effect as a result of them. But one of the most important is that they believe that our energy intensity of our economies is going to decrease. And that is going to be extraordinarily difficult to achieve, and without the aid of massive technological innovation. So when we think about the wage demand growth that we're seeing in the low wage sector, it looks increasingly likely that that is just not going to last, because companies are already investing in any kind of technology that can get rid of low-skilled workers. And some of the pioneers in that have been the fast food restaurants, because they have historically relied on low-skilled workers. And there's this startling statistic that it's a remarkably high percentage of people have worked at one stage or another in their lives at McDonald's. I know my brother's first summer job was at a McDonald's. So when we think about the focus that they're starting to put on technological solutions, and then the potential that eventually we're just going to have fully automated restaurants. And then we can also think about the drive-through experience and how much do you really interact with a real person? And if there were a machine that could simply do everything for you, well, why on earth would you need to interact with an individual at all? What it suggests is that low-skilled workers are increasingly going to find it difficult to find gainful employment, because as wages rise, then they're going to find themselves in a difficult scenario. What that also suggests is that there's going to be increasing pressure on governments to provide social programs, because we've had a taste of what outsized stimulus looks like. And certainly, governments have also had this experience with populist revolutions. Well, we can think again about that period between about 2012 and what was it, 2011 and 2014, when low wage demand growth, or wages demand growth, was significantly below the inflation rate. And that resulted in a populist revolution. And the one thing that happened after as that revolution gained power and eventually resulted in Donald Trump being elected president, was that the overall wage rate was above the inflation rate. So the big question then is, at what point will inflation peak? And where will it settle? It's not so much that inflation is going to continue rising at 5% a year. That's extremely unlikely. It's more about where is it going to settle afterwards. Because we continue to get these spiky environments, and we also get this increasing demand for new money creation. So the USA is looking at a significant additional new spending program. And they're going to have a debate about just how large that program will be and what kind of additional supports in terms of social spending will result from it. And there's a lot of discussion right now about the opportunity that was missed as a result of 9/11 20 years ago, that instead of going off and invading Iraq and Afghanistan, that perhaps the money would have been better spent on reorienting the economy and trying to reduce reliance on foreign oil. Well, today, that same discussion is instead we should be looking after our own people. And I think people are increasingly aware of the sacrifices that were made in service to globalization in the early 2000s, because millions of jobs right across North America and Europe were exported to the emerging markets. And there was that was done in the interests of labor in the emerging markets, in supporting the revolution in terms of development for the emerging markets and for the third world. And in return, we all got cheaper goods, but we did not get, for a substantial proportion of the economy, the ability to pay for those goods. So in many respects, it was simply an adoption of a bread and circuses policy by developed markets in order to preserve the profitability of corporations and to create markets for exports in the emerging markets. And a whole portion of the middle class were sacrificed in service to those objectives. And this is now leading to demand for more social programs. So the dollar remains quite steady. And the dollar index has been hovering here around the trend mean now for most of the last quarter, and it was down over the last 2 weeks and a little bit steadier in here this week. So there's two ways of thinking about this. The first is that this is support in the region of the lower side of the 6-year range. Alternatively, it's a distribution before an eventual break downwards. And of course, a lot is going to depend upon how high do bond yields go, and how willing will the US government be to engage in massive additional fiscal spending. Well, they certainly plan on spending a great deal more money, but it's not happening just yet. One thing, though, I think is particularly relevant is bond yields have steadied, and they continue to hold a sequence of higher reaction lows. The most important thing that's happened is that it has broken the downtrend from the peak in March. Well, what that suggests is that there is some reticence at the thought of funding these additional social programs, and particularly when the Federal Reserve is talking about tapering. So we're going to remain in a very liquidity-rich environment for the foreseeable future, because earlier this week the ECB said that they're not tapering and then announced that they're going to reduce the number of bonds that they're buying in December. So they are tapering. But the pace of the taper is going to be very slow. And Australia announced that they've already been tapering and they're going to slow down the pace of the taper. So we're seeing central banks almost universally line up behind the conclusion that they want to taper because their economies are recovering, but that they're not going to do anything to endanger the expansion overall. So we're going to remain in a liquidity-rich environment, and inflationary pressures are still very much present. And with the transition that is being pioneered in the wider economy, this looks more like a copper-led commodity bull market than an oil-led commodity bull market. Copper prices were up in a meaningful manner in here this week, and a good part of the reason for that is because some of the pressure is coming off of Tencent. The Chinese administration announced yesterday that they are going to allow the company to negotiate some or renegotiate some of its credit agreements. It doesn't mean that the company won't go bust, but that they probably will get a chance to sell some of their assets, and that there will be efforts underway to try and insulate the wider economy from the fallout from an eventual default of China Evergrande. So the government is also expressing at least some recognition that the potential for contagion in the property market is not a desirable outcome, and that is a gross understatement. So that's helping to support commodity prices. Because if pressure comes off of the property development sector, that's a significant proportion of economic growth and demand for commodities generally. So copper was stronger in here today. Steel prices or iron ore prices have been pulling back and they're quite likely to steady. Lithium prices have been surging on the upside. And well, let me just pull up that chart because it's easier to find it on it's easier to find it on my website than it is on Bloomberg. So when we think about the lithium price, it has been accelerating higher and is now coming back up into the region of the peaks from back in 2016 through 18. A number of the lithium miners have surged right along with it. Orocobre has been trending higher in quite a consistent manner, and it has a series of equal-sized ranges, with the weakness that we've seen this week and 3 weeks ago. This looks like another equal-sized consolidation and a pause in the region of the psychological $10 area. It would really need to sustain a move below 8 to really question the consistency of this advance overall. And then the lithium and battery technology ETF continues to push on the upside as well. So there's lots of investment moving into the electric vehicle market, into the renewable energy infrastructure market. And I do think that it's in the commodities is the easiest way to play this sector because the profitability of the individual companies is extremely interest rate sensitive. And there is, with the intention of central banks to reduce the number of purchases, coupled up with the intention of governments to increase the amount of money that they're spending, particularly the USA, well, those are incompatible objectives. And sooner or later, the Federal Reserve is going to have to buy the bonds that the US government is issuing because the upper pressure that that would put on yields would put the economic expansion in significant peril. So I think it's extremely likely that we're going to see the US lag in terms of its ability to withdraw liquidity. Whereas in the UK, the significant spending measures that were announced this week are going to be revenue neutral. So that's helping to support the pound. The UK has been among the most forthright of central banks in clearly stating that they, and certainly the Chancellor, has been clear in stating that they want to return to normal. So that's helping the pound to steady, and it's certainly a source of relative strength. One thing that is an additional source of potential inflation is food prices, because there has been damage to global supply chains, and we have significant weather events that have been occurring. The drought in Brazil, the drought in Canada, the floods in Europe, these have all been significant issues, and they are contributing to the perception of very significant climate change. One of the futures to pay particular attention to is wheat because it's a staple food. And there was news today that pasta prices are increasingly going to rise because semolina prices are increasing. Whereas wheat can be stored for up to 2 years, semolina goes off after a month. So you need a steady supply of it to create pasta. And wheat semolina is in short supply because of droughts. So that's contributing to the upward trend in wheat. Even though it's been down over the last 3 weeks, it's coming back into the region of the trend mean. So when we think about whether inflation is going to be transitory, then it's an awfully big question. And central banks are making an awfully big bet that it's going to be transitory. Whereas there are lots of additional factors that are contributing to the perception that it's not going to be transitory. So a lot of people are wondering about why gold isn't doing better. And the price was down a bit in here today, and it's still hovering around the $1,800 area. And people are worried about the correlation between the gold price and bond prices. So when bond prices are weaker, then that contributes to weaker gold prices. And there's no denying that that has been something of a correlation because of the upward pressure on interest rates. But the reality is that we're not going to see interest rates rising anytime soon. And the upward pressure on yields is only going to put further pressure on central banks to buy the bonds and ensure that yields remain low. And that is part of the reason why the ECB was so clear in stating that this isn't a taper, because what they're really saying is that the ECB is going to ensure that bond yields stay down. So we can just think about what's happened in terms of the Italian 10-year. And bond yields there are now down to about 70 basis points. So they were down yesterday and a little bit stronger in here today, but we're still below 1%. And that was previously the lowest that yields had ever been in Italy. So I certainly think that there are inflationary pressures, and there are central banks who are much more interested in ensuring that those yields don't rise against a background of rising inflation. So we're still in a negative real interest rate environment. From a gold perspective, what people want to see is an increasingly wide negative real interest rate. I think that's one of the most important factors, that we had a big move in real interest rates that helped to propel gold. Then the negative real interest rate environment hasn't been getting progressively better, so gold prices haven't gone much of anywhere. But when we think about where we are in terms of this cycle, well, we're still in a very liquidity-rich environment, and governments are going to ensure negative real interest rates for the foreseeable future. And that's likely to continue to represent a tailwind for gold over the medium term. But we're still in an environment where it's a medium-term correction, and people don't have the clear incentive yet to just bank on gold over other assets. So we're still in this choppy environment. Nonetheless, I think that it is quite likely that the low was at 1700, and that the sharp rebound and the inability to hold the move below 1700 was a meaningful event. So that suggests to me at least that we're unlikely to see prices drop below that level, and that it's likely that we'll put in a higher reaction low above it. On the other hand, when we look at what's happening in the platinum market, it did break downwards in here today. It's much more of an industrial resource than it is a precious metal, and it is now sustaining a move back down into its base formation. Part of the reason for that is because of the profound decline that we're seeing in the palladium market. So palladium is coming back in a very dynamic manner, and it looks increasingly likely that this bull market is over, and the closing or the shuttering of production facilities in the automotive sector because of a lack of semiconductors, which is again another significant result of the pandemic, is contributing to less demand for palladium. So prices are starting to come back down, and that's also putting pressure on platinum. It's not necessarily much to do with the perception of the outlook for precious metals. And silver is also a little weaker in here today, but not in an especially dynamic manner. And I think that it is still quite likely that it is going to hold the lower side of this range. But it's for the bulls to prove. It certainly needs to sustain a move back above the trend mean in order to clearly confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment overall. And then, of course, we have the outlook for cryptocurrencies. And this is where people seem to have the most confidence about what the future holds. And we can think about all of the prognostications that have been made about the energy sector, and then think about all of the guesses about the future that have been made about Bitcoin, because people have been betting for the longest time that it's going to disappear entirely. And then we also have people betting that the price is going to multiply from whatever level anyone chooses to pick. Just in here today, I saw a forecast for Ethereum that it would trade up to $30,000. So people are looking at another 10x move. And that's why people are interested in the sector. But when I see predictions that are 10x higher after a massive downward dynamic, well, that's not confidence inducing, because the market is doing one thing and predictions are doing something else. And we had an awfully big downward dynamic 4 days ago, and since then the price has not rebounded. So the risk is that we're going to see an additional correction. Now, people have been conditioned to buy the dip, which means that we're going to see additional instances of volatile trading. But the biggest challenge for me, at least, is that we had a very consistent trend upwards in from 2020 through to the peak in March of 2021. And the big decline was a massive inconsistency. Then we had a recovery, and now that has been capped with an extraordinarily large downward dynamic. And it's a very big key reversal. So a key reversal, and we haven't exactly got follow through yet, but it certainly hasn't been negated. One would have to conclude that we're looking at a more bearish environment overall. I saw a news story today from Matt Levine, and he's a really engaging writer on Bloomberg, and he really does some great work in terms of just highlighting legal issues. But I thought this was a particularly interesting article that he posted today, where fungible slices of non-fungible tokens, which is almost like double Dutch, but what he's basically making the point was that somebody originally made a non-fungible asset and sold it for $4 million. And then somebody took slices of that and started selling access or pieces of the non-fungible token. And because selling them was so successful, increased the value of the asset to $220 million. Well, that's really emblematic of really bubbly behavior. And it would be one thing if that was occurring after a major decline and prices were depressed and nobody was interested. But when that kind of thing happens after a really big run on the upside, and then we start to see downward dynamics after big accelerations, well, then it's certainly a cautionary tale, and it's something that we need to pay attention to, because the risk in the market has increased substantially, and not least as we're right in the region of the peaks from back in May. So we've had a really nice run up from the lows in July, and now prices look susceptible to additional downside. And that money has to go somewhere. So some of it is going to represent leverage getting taken out of the system. And then cash being raised will go to try to find other assets. And The stock market remains in a reasonably benign environment overall. When we think about the S&P 500, it has been down for 4 consecutive days. We're starting to see that the VIX index is starting to push back on the upside. We've had pullbacks on the S&P 500 in the middle of the month for the last 4 consecutive months. Today's the 10th, so we're starting to see some weakness coming through. If this pattern is going to be sustained, then we'll see the 25 area retested and then dip buying starting to come back in. But longer term, as long as liquidity is abundant and interest rates are low, then we may occasionally see reactions towards the mean, but there'll be buying opportunities, provided interest rates are still down. And I think that's likely to remain the case for the foreseeable future. So, with that, I'll leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.